Is the West Indies tour finally over? Why do we value our own lives so little? What's the latest with Trump? And does building a mammoth statue in India make sense? Hear Arnab talk about all this and more right now. Welcome back to episode 14 of Attention Please podcast. This is Vikram Mohan from the Talking Stuff Network. We are recording this on 3rd of November, India time. We don't have a guest this week. So as the big bad wolf would say, all the more of Arnab to listen to, my dear. So let me quickly get out of the way and get in Arnab. Welcome back, Arnab.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And for those of you who had problem with the audio last time, there was some problem. I think Vikram, you have a re-edited version out, so those of you who would want to listen to it again, I don't know if all the problems were fixed, because I didn't listen to the second version, by the way. So I don't know what happened, but for those of you who thought Suhail wasn't talking over me, it was just that was the synchronization problem between the tracks, which made it look like that was the case. And one person wrote an email saying I was talking over Suhail, so I don't know which version that was. But none of us were talking over each other. It was just that the audio was bad. I think we've changed our platform also from this time, and I hope that it'll be better. So, anyways, without further ado, let's move on to our first segment. This actually happened. So today, every time I seem to have a podcast, we kind of talk about the West Indies series. Now that it's ended, finally. Has it ended? I hope it has.
I think it has.
Yeah. So this West Indies series was basically end rega for Ravi Shastri. So this guaranteed that you'll have 180 days of work. And since now we have forgotten the England series, and now we are hopefully heading to Australia, where the team has been much weakened. For those of you who have seen Australia play Pakistan recently, it was disappointing. It was terrible seeing Australia, the vaunted Australia that we grew up watching, struggling to beat a rather subpar Pakistan, I would still say. Again, these things would be different once it's in Australia, and once Indians get into their habit of, getting out for less than 200 runs in Australia. So I'm not saying it's going to be easy, but this is a much weakened Australia. This has got nothing to do with the Australia we kind of like, the golden test, the test by fire that Australia in Australia is. If we can't beat these guys, it's really not much to say. The Australia as it is right now. So that's ended. So, again, I don't know why we have... I think the one-day series was reasonably competitive. Again, it wasn't competitive, but West Indies fought a little bit because I think, of course, West Indies is a fairly decent limited over side, even though, as I think we discussed last time, whenever they make a little bit of money, they decide to become franchise freelance players because the West Indies board doesn't pay them. And so they keep on losing their best players. I'm pretty sure that, what's his name, Heitmeier? I think he's gone. I'm pretty sure he'll be playing in the Afghanistan Premier League within a year. And Bangladesh Premier League, he'll basically be doing the whole Premier League circuit, and he'll be gone. Leaving only Marlon Samuels in the team. And how old is Marlon Samuels? He's been playing forever. My goodness.
Forever.
And then he was banned, I think, for some years also. So he's the only guy who will be left. Anyways, moving on to the second item for today, the Statue of Unity, which seems to occupy an inordinate amount of space in our public discourse as of now. Well, at least for the last few days. And what I find amusing is the. It's almost like I don't understand how something as naive can even be written and be expected to taken seriously when people say that, we did the calculation, it would take like 120 years for gate receipts to pay for the Statue of Unity. Well, Statue of Unity is really basically a public infrastructure project. It's the government spending for creating some kind of public infrastructure. I'll come to it whether I think it's the proper public infrastructure to build. For me, it's not. But it should not be evaluated as purely as, here's the statue, it cost X amount of rupees, here's a gate receipt, let's divide this by this, and look at how many years it will require. That's not the way the value of something like this is calculated. If you look at Mount Rushmore, the money that Mount Rushmore has made hasn't come from the ticket receipts. It comes from the growth of a tourism ecosystem, the growth of townships, the growth of everything that comes with. And this, the Tower of the Statue of Unity has been constructed in the backwaters of Gujarat. Now you can say, why is Gujarat? Why not somewhere else? We know why it's Gujarat, because it's the Prime Minister's state. He did it when he was the Chief Minister of State. Of course, it's going to be in Gujarat. So you can say, well, there are other underdeveloped parts of the country. Yes, sure, Gujarat is going to get chosen. Deal with it. But the problem is, is it a good thing for the government to invest in making a statue? For me, the whole pride aspect of it, I mean, the reason why I oppose this statue is because I think it's a good idea for government to have public, infrastructure projects. I just don't think this is the best use of the money, because this is not direct infrastructure. Direct infrastructure would be doing something like railroads, roads, river linking. Those are direct infrastructure items. For me, for somebody who believes in the reduced role of government, the government should only go into investing in sectors where it does not make sense for the private industry to invest. For the private industry to recover money, they would have to wait for so long a time that it does not, that no private industry would actually go into such a project. For instance, building railways, that goes into Nagaland, remote areas. It doesn't make business sense. The amount of investment you need to do, one private player just cannot do. So because the fact that the government, the reason why the government spends money, it's not just profit making. Profit making has to be part of it, because ultimately you do at least have to recover the money, if not make money. But there's also a social aspect of the spending, that the government is doing something to make people's lives better. Now, private industry does not have any intent of making people's lives better. It exists purely for the motive of making money. So that's why you have to have public and private partnership. I don't believe that there is no role of the government, but is it the role of the government to build huge statues? That is the, I just don't think, and again, I don't have numbers, but I'm going to go with that this is not the best use of public money to do something. But yes, it's not as useless as the Congress-aligned press are making it out to be, that this is something which is absolutely unrecoverable, it's a total boondoggle. No, it's not. It is a public infrastructure project. Yes, there's a lot of politics behind it. That's true. There's no denying that, the fact that it's in Gujarat, that Modi is trying to appropriate the legacy of Vallabhbhai Patel. These are all political things. So something like this cannot just be evaluated in terms of how much money it makes. Now, I would like it to be, because for me, this is government money. This is our money. I don't want my money to be used for making a political point. However, I do agree that this is an inevitability in today's world. And given the ethos that has been built up by naming everything by Nehru or Gandhi, we have not had a problem with that. Or not as big a problem as we have had with building one statue after Sardar Vallabhbhai Patel. I understand it's a big statue, and I understand it's a lot of money. And I also say that it's not maybe the best use of the government's money. There are perhaps better ways that the money could have been spent. But I also don't think that it's absolutely as useless as it's being made out to be by some sections of the media, and I don't want to rail against them repeatedly, that we know are inordinately, the nothing that the government do will make them happy, really, because they've already thrown their hat into the ring for the other guy. Which brings me to the second story. Go on, Vikram.
I had a question for you here. So, typically people on either side of the aisle, the right or left, they use this argument often, right? Can India afford XYZ when we have starving people? You can replace XYZ with bullet train, a monstrous statue, or even the space program. So this is, like I said, it's used by both the left and right based on what XYZ is.
Absolutely.
So how do you respond?
So Sam Pitroza a long time ago said this. So again, this was in the 80s when we were even more starving than we are now. And in those days when they were talking about investing in broad, in, you know, the information superhighway, as it was called, and telecom, there were a lot of people, especially in Bengal, which was a bastion and still is a bastion of leftists, who said, are these guys insane? We have people starving. We have, you know, people subsisting on 5 rupees a day in areas. We have people dying of starvation in Kalahandi. And these guys are talking about telecom and information superhighways. There are much more urgent calls on the public money than investing in this. And I remember Sam Pitroza said that it has to be both. It can't be either or. We can't say we will fix everything, all the problems we have, and then we will get into, you know, try to integrate ourselves with the world as it is, where it's going. Because then we will find ourselves in exactly the same situation, because the world would have moved ahead. Now, I'm not saying that this statue is the same thing as an information superhighway and the kind of investments at that point of time, which seemed crazy. And so there's only one good thing about Rajiv Gandhi I can say is that, again, this is again something which the right wants to deny. Now, that's the problem. People want to deny even the few good things somebody did, whether it be Rajiv Gandhi or Modi or whoever. But what Rajiv Gandhi did do, because I was alive at that time, was that he brought into vocabulary, he brought into the public lexicon these things which otherwise we had no way of knowing. The word information superhighway, these things, these concepts, I remember at least Sam Pitroza talking about it a lot in those. So again, this is always used. Why do we do space? The reason why we do space research, first of all, there are two reasons why we do space research. First of all, we do space research because some part of our money, just like we have to create icons and monuments, it's the main thing is how much, and this might be a little bit too much with the Statue of Unity. We also have to spend something for aspirational projects, some large goal for the country, which is not divisive. So going to space, these kinds of goals are something which all of us can agree on. And this kind of goal is not something which is done at the detriment of somebody else. Some of our goals sometimes are, you know, build the mandir, but then where goes the masjid? You know, so there's always a yes, but then somebody has to lose. Going to space is something where nobody has to lose. Plus, it captures people's imaginations. Secondly, a lot of scientific discoveries happen because of this focus, this mission. So there is the need for these kinds of scientific missions. I think it helps everyone. And it just doesn't mean that we can't do this because we have poverty. The poverty will stay. And if we try to spend all money on poverty and spend $0 on this, then we will always remain poor. The fact that in the 80s we chose to divert some of our welfare money into some kind of forward investments and doing something of, I remember, computerization in schools in the 80s, that we chose to do that, even though it was very controversial in those days, and it could have been tokenism also. But the fact that we did it, I think it's in no small way a contributor to the way India was able to get on to at least Y2K. Way before other countries figured it out. So, moving on. I wanted to bring to attention a new story which unfortunately has been forgotten because it happened a week ago, which was the absolutely horrific, horrific train accident in Amritsar. Now, it's the purpose of bringing this up is not to, well, it is to point fingers in many ways, but I think it's symptomatic of one of the biggest malaises in Indian society, which is the absolute lackadaisical attitude towards public safety. I remember once when I was, I was in Jadavpur University, I was walking down Gold Park. Yeah, I used to walk from Jadavpur University to my house because it was good exercise and I would save on the bus fare. Somewhere around Gold Park, where there is this sweet shop, Mocha, I was walking and suddenly, right, inches in front of me, a broken brick fell. Right in front of me. I looked up and apparently somebody was fixing. So there was this bamboos hung above, which obviously I couldn't see. There was nobody who had cordoned off the footpath. And there were people hanging and working on the bamboos. Okay, so they could fall also on me. So there is no public safety downstairs. There's no public safety upstairs. I looked up and this guy had a face which was like, what the f*** am I supposed to do? I get it. You're standing on this small bamboo road. You're unsafe. But I could have just died. That piece of brick, if it had hit me from 3 stories high on my head, I would be dead or very close to dead. And this is something which is considered to be okay, at least in those days. So when Calcutta used to flood, water would come up to our knees or to thighs, and there would be open manhole covers. And everybody knew there would be children, schools. It's right outside the school. There was an open manhole cover.
All over India.
All over India. Schools are not closed. Nothing's happening. There are kids walking. There's obviously a chance that somebody might die. Now, the thing is, nobody's died yet. So, who cares? But this whole approach to public safety, I think one of the, at least for many people who come abroad, especially they come to the US, they see an absolute total swing to the other end, where it's almost as if the society is infantilized. Like, everything is public safety. Especially if you stay in California like I do. Like, there is every regulation for everything. You can't do anything because everything is public safety. This is another extreme. But in India, once the details of the thing come out, then you can have accidents. There are accidents. I mean, yes, trains go off the lines, trucks hit each other, people fall off while taking selfies. I get it. Accidents happen. But this wasn't an accident. If you stand on the railway line, not just one person, but so many people standing on the railway line in full view of the organizers actually being proud of the fact that people are risking their lives, the show is that good. They're seeking validation from the fact before the people die that there are people standing on the train line risking their lives. It just boggles the mind. And in India, that's par for the course. I don't know. And again, I see also this, the Diwali time comes and people are very concerned about environmental pollution. And this might be okay. But there are far bigger public safety problems in India. Open manholes, for one. The fact that you have people and workmen who are working without the minimum, without any safety harness. I mean, it's been years that I've been staying in India, but Vikram, you can tell me, do people work with safety harnesses in India when they're repairing outside walls nowadays? I don't think they do.
You see it in the corporate buildings, but not in the apartments which are being built. They have a rope.
In Puja Pandals, I've seen, even really recently, I've seen Puja Pandals being constructed. They're three stories, four storied high Puja Pandals. If you fall from there, you'll die. People are just, they're just balancing themselves on these really thin bamboo poles. That's it.
Political cutouts. I've seen people scale huge political cutouts and garland or pour milk without any regard for safety.
And I think there's almost a sense of nostalgia. Maybe I've indulged it in myself. So when Eden Gardens went from 100,000 to 60,000 that it is now, a lot of people who were very disappointed with what happened, because what the Eden Gardens was trying to do was enforce some kind of public safety, because that 100,000 thing was like a death trap. Anybody who's ever been in Eden Gardens when it was 100,000, you kind of had this sense that you were in a death trap, that anything could happen, because there are 100,000 with these small doors. If anything happens, then you are going to be crushed to death. Now they reduced the capacity. I'm not saying that it's still, it still would come up to California standards, but it's okay. It's much better now. It's reasonable. But 100,000, it never was. But have you ever heard anybody saying, I don't think I'm going to go to the Eden Gardens. I might die there. No, nobody says that. At least now people wear seatbelts in India. When we were growing up, nobody wore seatbelts. I don't think people use child seats in India. Is that common, Vikram? I don't think so.
Very uncommon. If you see a child seat in a car, you know that that person's returned from the States.
Yes, that's good. Returned from the United States. But over here, it's compulsory. If I don't have my child in a child seat, I will get pulled over by a cop and I'll get a traffic ticket. So in many ways, we have the latest iPhones. We have the iPhone, you know, the Pixel 3. We buy them the moment they come in the US and in everywhere. We are kind of there. But with respect to public safety, I kind of wonder, and it kind of comes through, right, somehow, that the cost of one life in India, especially if the life is that of somebody who's poor, of course it matters, you know, whose life it is. Of course, Taimur Khan's life is not the same as normal person in the street's life. But we don't, as a country, give, maybe because we have so many lives, that's a cynical way of putting it, but we don't put too much cost on one person's life. And this kind of manifests itself. You know, people die. You know, we kind of accept that. As long as I don't die and somebody else does that, and then it's just a tragedy. But people die. And we as a society are not willing to pay for it. I mean, what is the option? So this is just not me ranting about this. So we as a society are not willing to pay the cost for public safety. That is where the problem happens. If you have any place where you try to enforce public safety, you cause inconvenience, right? You limit people from coming in. Because you know, public safety isn't a fun thing. Firstly, it costs money to have people impose public safety, which we're not willing to pay. And it also creates, there are things which you can't do. 100,000 people can't come into the Eden Gardens, only 60,000 people can. And everything is seen as an inconvenience. So those guys, if they had not been standing on the train line, they would have possibly seen the show a little further back, I'm guessing. And maybe trains would be coming between them and the show. But that was not something which they were willing to tolerate. They were prepared to stand on front. And I still don't understand what were they thinking, that the trains will not be coming, that they'll be able to run away before the train comes. Again, it just boggles the mind. And I've seen this. I mean, the fact that these kind of things happen so seldom is really the most surprising thing. Really, there should be even more of these if we actually think about it. I mean, even in train tracks, I mean, I've seen that all the time. You know, train tracks are, you know, kids playing right next to train tracks. There's no separation. There's no physical separation from the train track, and we have so many hundreds of miles of train tracks. I understand that you can't do it for every mile of train track, but surely some of it you can. Again, if you've noticed, Vikram, nobody's talking about this thing anymore. It's gone.
No, it's gone.
I haven't seen. I mean, I haven't seen this. At least I personally haven't been seeing. I mean, the conversation has moved on to the statue and to what Divya Swandana said, and you know, trivialities like that. So,
but that's always the case, isn't it? I mean, even in Hyderabad, I routinely stop my car for pedestrians right under pedestrian crossings. Even in expressways, people cross. I mean, something is fundamentally wrong with our inbuilt cost-benefit analysis, right? Where we say a 1% chance of death is, you know, acceptable for a little convenience. For a race which we claim to be genetically good in math, I think we suck at it.
Yes, I one of the problems of being a NRI is that once nowadays when I go to India, I find I can't cross the street because my my instinct is gone. Before that, I wouldn't even think. Now I can't cross Gariahat. I'm like the physical proximity of objects. I'm like an autonomous car which is not trained for that safety cage. I can't get down. Nobody will stop for me. Like there is no question of priority. So in Calcutta at least, yes.
I had to tell you this. So last two vacations we had in India, one was in Kerala, one was in Karnataka. I mean, just going by your point, we went on a boat ride. And these are not backward states, right? I mean, Kerala is probably one of the biggest tourist attractions in India. In both these cases, they didn't have life jackets for the in the boat. And in both the places, when I asked for the, you know, whether they have life jackets, I got the same reply. Asking when that guy, first of all, gave me a dirty look. Then he asked, are you from the US? US returned, okay. Kind of. Both the places, in both Kerala and Karnataka.
I think, you know, concluding this, I think the actual algorithm that works in our mind, and I have heard this being articulated as when you're trying to cross Gariahat, you know, the cars are coming, they're not stopping, right? Nobody's stopping. So the trick is that when you're alone, let's say you're the only guy who's going to cross, don't cross because the car will hit you. But wait for 100 people to come. Then at one moment, the whole swarm decides to move in. Okay. Then the cars have to stop. Or out of the 100, one will die. It won't be you. Because you have a 1 by 100 chance of doing, of dying. I think that's the way the whole crowd psychology works. I think this was what worked in the train example also. I think somewhere, I don't think it was a conscious decision process, but they also felt there are so many of us. What could happen? The train can't kill all of us, can it? Yes, it can. It's a train. But that's really ingrained. So, you know, people don't consciously. So that this is the fascinating thing for me, you know, having come here. And I also used to be like really lackadaisical about public safety. I would like walk streets. I would just, you know, and that's the only way you can cross in India. You just have to just walk out onto the street and just hope that the car is intimidated by you and stops. But even the car won't stop. And the car will try to intimidate. So it's a game of intimidation between, I mean, who blinks first. And that becomes so ingrained into us that, you know, we whenever the, for instance, when the plane stops, all of us get up and try to go for it, right? But these things are not something which I think comes from our conscious decision-making process. It comes from living in a place where there are a lot of people. And these kind of get ingrained into our subconscious processes. This lack of, let's say, this. I mean, you think that for a human being, self-preservation would be the highest priority. But we kind of think that we have safety in numbers. And the moment you come to the US and when you have to unlearn that, and the unlearning happens pretty quickly. But then when you go back to India, you find it very difficult. I just cannot. For instance, I will never drive in India. There's no two ways about it. I used to drive at one point of time, but now obviously I cannot. And I find it difficult to cross roads nowadays. I'm almost embarrassed to say it, but I just can't. I mean, this, I have to make a conscious effort to say, I'm going to cross the road now and do it. Because there's a part of me which which makes me step back because of there's an auto coming from that side and there's a, you know, another bike which is coming behind me. Even though I'm like 2 feet, I'm like taken 2 steps out of the crease. There's somebody trying to squeeze between me and the footpath. So yeah. Anyways, moving on to the feature story of today, which is Donald Trump recently said that he's going to deny citizenship for children born in the U.S. of illegal immigrants, which shouldn't really worry Desis that much because there are not a lot of Desis, I guess, who are illegal immigrants. But from what I understand, those who have non-permanent visas. So I'm not an immigration lawyer, but this could affect, not retroactively, hopefully, but H1s and B1s, I think. I'm not sure. It's only what he's proposing to do, which I frankly believe that he has absolutely no chance of doing, is to basically take back the 14th Amendment of the US. Now, I honestly feel, of course, this has caused a lot of panic among the Desi community and I totally understand why. And that is exactly what Trump wants to do. As I think I said before, the real target of Trump isn't the Mexican illegal immigrant. It's the Indian immigrant who is his real problem. He can't articulate it. But Steve Bannon, if you feel that even a little bit of knowledge of Steve Bannon's work, he's not so much concerned. I mean, his main base are people in the US who have lost their jobs due to outsourcing. That's his main base. The jobs that illegal immigrants take, which are on farms, you know, blowing leaves, they haven't taken anyone's jobs. There are nobody who can do. They don't want to do these jobs in the US. So for Trump, who basically who uses foreign labor in his own resorts, he knows very well that the US and his friends cannot survive without illegal immigration. His main thing is to stop legal immigration, especially legal immigration in high-tech jobs. That's one of the aims that the Steve Bannons in the world have. That's really the base. Again, it's not a huge base, but even in India, we spend so much time on social media. How much of social media actually translates to votes? Not much, right? But still, we have all this IT cell, which does so much of work. I mean, all parties have IT cells now. And they do a lot because this is an influential section. It's not that these guys necessarily swing votes, but these are the guys who write articles, watch TV, read newspapers. You know, this is a nice closed circle. And they all know, especially in the US, that this is the circle to which the immigration thing appeals to. So one thing, another one thing is, I don't know if you know, Vikram, but Desis who once get their green card and US citizenship are absolutely pro-Trump because they don't want the next Desi to come in. So I've seen that time and time again. So it's like, I suffered for so many years, I want you to suffer even more. So the worst, the most intense Bannon fan, they won't accept it, are essentially Indians who have already gotten their green card and US citizenship. Not that they would accept it. So, but again, coming back to what Trump is doing, Trump is basically ratcheting up the tension. I mean, this is the midterms are going to happen soon. So before we talk about the pathology of Trump, it's important to understand that for many Indians, especially those who have gotten their green cards, they are very much for stopping legal immigration, because the psychology, and I'm not just saying this is an Indian thing, I think the psychology of people in general is that once they feel they have done their time, they want to make it more difficult for those who are coming after them. They kind of feel that they have been cheated if the people coming after them get away easy. I don't know if you've had your uncles or anybody tell you this, but in our days, we didn't have fans. You know, we used to sit in, you know, 40 degrees Celsius weather and, you know, do our homework. Why do you need fans? So that's always been there. The fact that, you know, we had it tough, so you should have it tougher, if not the same amount of tough. So I get to hear this often, that how can Indians support Trump? Well, they do support Trump because, you know, they already have their green cards, and the people who are, if any Indians, and I'm pretty sure a lot of Indians have voted for Trump, it's because they already have their US citizenship. That's the reason why they can vote. And Indians who can vote are likely to be, at least on immigration, more aligned with Trump than on their opponents, paradoxically, but not really. So for Trump, one of the things is that the midterms are this week, and the Republicans are likely not to do well. And this is the time that Trump needs to really rally the base. Now, at one point of time, politics was all about bringing people, like, if you are considered to be an extreme element, your gambit is to move to the center in order to get votes. For instance, for the BJP, during Vajpayee and Advani's times, even when they were perceived as being Hindu right-wing, they basically became electable by moving to the center.
Right.
Nowadays, with the new politics, it's been turned on its head. Now everybody wants to move to the sides. It's very dangerous to play in the center. You can see this with the Congress also, with the kind of rhetoric that Divya Spandana, for instance, is putting out. I mean, this is not just accident, and I'm kind of digressing over here. The kind of vile that the IT cell has been through, and they can also point to the BJP and say, you know, the BJP started it. But, you know, I think the Congress has also decided that there's no more playing nice guy. I mean, of course, Rahul Gandhi is going to pretend to play the nice guy, but the IT cell has to really, really, you know, if BJP brings it down, then the Congress needs to bring it down. Like, before that, it was often about raising the game. Now it's bringing your game down. So if the BJP hit two, these guys need to hit, you know, zero Kelvin in order to really make an impact. And so with Trump, it's also that. So why did Trump bring up this, I will not allow children born here to be U.S. citizens if they are just not in, not just because illegal immigrants, but it's also for people who are non-permanent residents, as much as far as I understand it, which is why ACs on H-1B might be a little concerned about this. But the reason he said this, I don't think he seriously intends to do this. I think he also knows, he's not a dumb guy. He also knows that it's not possible to do this. It's not possible to overturn the 14th Amendment through an executive order, which is really the president signing something and saying, "Thou, it shall be thus." What he's trying to do at this point of time, at this very late game, is to swing to the right. Now, normally, this was not going to be his card. His card was going to be Hillary Clinton, the fake news CNN. But then these pipe bombs, which got sent, that kind of queried his pitch. Now, he can't go to that rhetoric.
Sympathy not right now.
Right now, he can't. Now, he can't go lock them up to Hillary, at least for a few weeks. So what's left? This idiot who was Trump's fan basically made it even more difficult for him by doing exactly what he wanted people to do, but in a rhetorical way. He actually went ahead and did it. And now Trump can't use the rhetoric just when he needed to use the rhetoric. So now he has to do this. Only one thing which he can say is that there are caravans of people coming like a zombie apocalypse. We have to send the army, so he's sending the military. It's almost as if creating this absolutely fake war. He's creating a diversion. That's the only diversion he can do now, given that his other primary diversion has been taken out of the equation by one of his idiot fans. He has to do this. So he has to ratchet up this tension. He has to take... He has realized, and he's a master of this, I think he understands the new wave of politics, which is to swing further away to the right or to the left. I think it's happening in India also, with each side getting progressively polarized and them reaping the benefits of this polarization. So you see gradually the absolute absence of a middle in discourse, in the media, in politics. The middle is now a vacuum. Everybody is swung to the sides. It's like a centrifuge. Nothing is in the center. The force is pushing things out to the periphery. And that's where really everybody is. It's become a donut now.
That's a great way to put it.
And one thing that I want to say about immigrants, immigration, and I can say this because I am an immigrant myself. So nowadays, the social justice warriors say that unless you are a part of an oppressed class, you can't talk about them. If you talk about them while not being an oppressed class, you're actually promoting the narrative of the oppressor. Anyways. In this case, allow me to say that, as an immigrant, a brown immigrant in the US, I can say this, that first of all, I think that US is a country which is very open to immigrants. I've said this before, any kind of anti-immigrant sentiment that I've ever encountered, I've encountered in the very few days that I've been in Europe. Like, I've been in Europe for perhaps 2 weeks of my life, I've encountered more anti-immigrant, anti-brown sentiment than in those two weeks that I've encountered in almost 20 years of being in the US. So the fact is that by and large, the US is very pro-immigrant in terms of the way normal people behave. Of course, there have been isolated incidents, but it's a drop in the ocean. So I can say that no, I do not suffer. There are many people say that the life has become terrible for immigrants under Trump. This is actually a mirror reflection of the narrative that you find in India with respect to minorities. There, I can't say that because then you'll say you're not a minority. First of all, you don't also stay in India. So how do you know? Okay, I stay in the US and I'm a minority and I can tell you there is no problem. No systemic problem. There might be some guy in the road. There might be isolated incidents. True. But overall, I wouldn't say that things have become worse under Trump. I will definitely not say that. But there's also this thing about this basic fundamental. We have problems in India with immigration too. Not with respect to people from other countries, but people moving from one state to another. We had problems in Gujarat, we've had problems in Maharashtra. So there is always this tension with immigrants as to should we assimilate or should we maintain our identity? Now, some people will say you should maintain your identity. Why shouldn't you maintain your identity? Now, here's where there's this difference between could you and should you. So I don't think that people have a problem, you know, for me as an immigrant, I can say this from my perspective. I guess I can't say what is right or wrong. But for me, I feel that I am a guest in this country and that I have to be a good guest. Nobody is coming into my house and checking to see if I'm listening to Hindi music or not. Okay, nobody's doing that. So I am allowed to maintain my identity. There is a certain amount of identity I'm allowed to maintain. But let's say if I decide that tomorrow that Diwali is coming, I'm going to go and burst crackers out in the street. Okay, or for Durga Puja, I'm going to construct a small pandal right next to the gate of our community. Okay, that's when the problem will start. Now, you were saying that nobody in the US does it. Because the laws and everything, they can't do it. But let's assume that you have so many Indians. And this is what's happened in places in France, Belgium, that there are areas which have been just so dominantly belonging to one community and one country that you can actually do this. You can actually cordon off parts of the city and become mini host countries. And once immigration reaches this place, and the great thing about US is whether through design or whether through accident, that's never happened. Immigrants haven't really ghettoized in the US. So there's never really, it's a little bit different in Canada where I've seen this happen. There are places in Toronto which are absolutely, absolutely right. ACIs. I don't think there's any place in the US which is like that. So in the US, again, I'll come back to that classic. I wrote a post about it once when they were constructing a mosque at 9/11. Could they? Sure. They have the right to. Should they? No, they should not. Because it would be seen something terrible. So there is a difference between could. Yes, you have the independence. You can buy property there and you can do whatever you want. You can open a strip club if you want. You can open a mosque if you want. You can open a shop if you want. You have the right to. Absolutely, you have the right to. If the zoning laws allows, you have the right to. But should you? Should you, given that that's the place where this happened, where there's so much grief, if something like this happened, you have the entire city, you have the entire country. Go and open it. But when you decide to open the mosque there, if you want to open it, you're trying to make a point. Right? This is not a question of I can't find any other place. That's also a very expensive real estate place, by the way. So for immigrants, for those who are not like the people who are the majority, it becomes contingent. This is my opinion. To know, and everybody knows where the line is. So people can't say, look, dude, I didn't know where the line is. You know what the line is, right? There's nobody who is going to come and say, look, you can't, you know, dress up in Indian clothes at home. You can't listen to Hindi music. But like I, for instance, me, I'm hardly assimilated into the US life. I mean, sure, I do Halloween. That's the only thing I do. But right. But otherwise, I follow cricket. I don't do any US sports. But I don't, when I go out, there's nothing that I do which is quintessentially makes me stand out in a crowd. So, for instance, I wouldn't walk around wearing a dhoti. Yeah, I just wouldn't do it. Firstly, it's cold. I mean, not in California, but all the places I've stayed, it was like monstrously cold. You wouldn't want to wear a dhoti. But other than that, you know, I just wouldn't do it. I wouldn't want to stand out and kind of, you know, make a point of my individuality. I think ultimately assimilation happens. It happens organically. It happens through generations. That's how culture is developed. Okay. So culture is by nature syncretic. I mean, ultimately, Hispanic elements come into the US. You know, it becomes part of the music. It becomes part of the popular culture. And that's how assimilation happens. But assimilation, you know, first of all, you can't force assimilation. And firstly, your individual culture will become part of the majority culture. That will happen, but it'll happen over time. And it'll happen only if you let it. And this is a problem I've seen in India. More in India because, you know, the rule of law is, let's say, more lax. In a way, we have this, I can talk about, so we have this, again, in Calcutta, during Durga Puja, people will just stop, you know, block the street and create pandals. There was a community of Bihari migrants, you know, they were living in behind our house, so they decided doing it for Chhat Puja and stuff. Now, that's where the problem started. Now, from their point of view, they can say, you know what, you guys block the streets too. Nobody has a problem then. True. Logically true. But it's just that in Calcutta, in those 4 days, every road is blocked. So it doesn't really stand out. Everybody knows. Life changes in those days. You don't take your car out, you walk, you take public transport. But on a day in which that is not true, because the majority is just going to work, you block a road, that's where the problem starts. And again, is it a big inconvenience? Can you take another road? Sure you can. But that kind of embeds in people's minds. And then you have politicians who are going to play to that. So I think similar things happen all around India. It's when you try to assert, and again, I get it, they're trying to assert their identity. But the assertion by itself, and again, I can say this, I would not assert my identity. I wouldn't make it a point to assert my identity in a place where I am an immigrant. That's a very important thing. I mean, again, could I? I could. Should I? I don't think so.
I think Wilmar has this very nice way of putting it. He said, when you're in a melting pot, you have to melt a little. So you come to a place like New York, or you come to even anywhere in the US, you know, because it's a melting pot. You're supposed to melt a little.
Everybody changes. The fact is, everybody changes, but you can't make anybody change. The reason why I've changed is because nobody in the US has made me change. Nobody has imposed anything on me. Nobody has come and said, no, you can't do this. If somebody comes and do this, maybe I will make it a point to assert my identity as a way of rebelling against them. But because nobody says it, I think it's also contingent upon me to respect the fact that nobody is explicitly coming and expecting me to assimilate. It's an honor system, right? And at that point of time, again, I don't assimilate. I don't think that I have to, you know, watch baseball to be, you know, to fit in. I don't. But there are things which I like. I watch and I blend in. I watch Netflix. I mean, I watch all the TV shows which are, you know, American. And I have conversation topics. But again, it happens because of the very nature of America, because I have to interact with Americans. Now, in places in Europe, for instance, you have entire communities where you don't really need to interact with anybody who's outside your foreign culture. They're and that's there in England, that's there in France, that's in Belgium. That's where the real problem happens. And you know, you had Angela Merkel saying at one point of time, multiculturalism has failed. And she's like as liberal as liberal can be.
Right.
So I think the reason why multiculturalism has failed in Europe, if one can say that's a very, very, fairly controversial statement to me, is because Europe inherited the legacy of colonialism. So there were people who just came into this country because they were part of their colonies. Right? That happened in Belgium, it happened in France. So in Europe, there was no really control. So I always maintain this, that the difference in immigration between US and Europe is, in Europe, they have very low bar for immigration. They pretty much let everyone in. But once they're in, they always point out that they're different. German footballers have said so. Everybody points out, Belgian footballers have said so, that the difference, they allow them in, but then this continuously, the home population says you're different. In the US, they allow very few people in. They're very bad in that respect. But once they allow people in, they may have a very high bar. But once they allow people in, they don't try to poke their finger in your eye and say you're different. If you choose to be different, they will do it. But they will assume an honor system where I won't poke you in the eye and you won't come and poke me in your eye with your difference. As long as we maintain that balance, we're okay. Again, this happens because there are not a lot of immigrants. They can't really form a community. And where they formed a community, that's why with Hispanic, there is sometimes a problem. That's why, you know, when Trump is saying they're sending their worst people here, of course, that's false. Okay, then overwhelmingly, I mean, the data says otherwise. There are less, the crime is less in their communities than it's in other communities, you know, traditional American communities. But they do it because he's trying to essentially ratchet up that fear that they're all going to bundle together and form a gang. that your way of life is at risk. And by the way, the thing with Mexican immigrants is their way of life is not much different from the traditional American way of life. I mean, they're all Christians in a way. It's right. And they're very devout Christians also. They're much more devout Christians than the traditional American, even the traditional American Christian right. They're much more Christian in terms of how observant they are. So there is really not a lot to distinguish themselves. Yes, there's the language. That's the only thing. It's the language. But other than that, well, there's not a lot. It's not as much as, say, somebody from Morocco coming to, you know, France. That there, the difference is much more stark. Again, if the difference between an Indian culture and American culture is a lot, but there's just not that many Indians here. And Indians also, we are so split up that the Americans think all of us as Indians, but we know that it's very difficult to characterize us as Indians. So, phew, we have some things, Bollywood and some things, but we're very different in many ways. So I think, summing up, the point that I wanted to, not really about Trump, but the fact that as an immigrant, wherever you are, whether you are a Bengali staying in Chennai, you have to make an effort. You have to make the effort, I believe, as an immigrant. You have to make an effort to learn the language. For instance, if the language is different. You've chosen to be there. They didn't call you there. Again, you have the right not to speak in their language, but it's not advisable. Otherwise, don't be there. You have other choices. So that for me is, with our social justice warriors often winning arguments and, you know, basically because of their stranglehold on media, we kind of see that the majority is always considered to be wrong. In this case, I would take a stance against that and say, well, the minority, and I'm saying this from my own perspective as a minority, I believe that there are things that I need to do in order for me, because I am a guest in this country. They didn't invite me. I came here on my own. I submitted my documents, jumped through a lot of hoops to be able to be here. And I know it's a privilege. I can say that. I'm an Indian citizen, but I stay here. I believe that I have an obligation. And I also believe that when in India too, when you immigrate, when the Bengali immigrates to Bangalore, or when the guy from Bihar immigrates to Maharashtra, they have an obligation. They have an obligation to assimilate somewhat. Not totally, but assimilate somewhat. Come to a middle ground. And ultimately, the culture of the main place, the majority place, will change. It will change. It will bring in your elements of your culture. And that's how culture grows. And again, you can't separate out. I mean, for instance, you know, that's why. And we can talk about it, you know, some other time. You know, that sometimes this very ham-handed approach of the Hindu right to sometimes separate out the Islamic elements from what we have. And for me, that's terrible. The Indian culture that I love is an assimilation. You can't separate it out. I mean, it's a chemical reaction which works just one way. You can't bring them stuff back and separate it out. It's no longer Indian at this point. So again, that's happened because the assimilation has taken place organically over hundreds of years to form what the Indian identity is, which is a mixture of, you know, Hindu, Muslim, you know, the whole idea of India, which unfortunately the whole word has been made, it has become become a political slogan more than anything else. But something good about the idea too. And that is because we as a country, we have not had a problem with immigrants in general ever in this country. Ever. Because we've always had this live and let live thing ingrained into our DNA. Just like we were talking about the bad thing about lack of public safety, we've also had some good things ingrained in our DNA. And this is that part. And that these are the things which kind of make me hopeful also. So on that note of hope, I would like to conclude for today's podcast.
Okay, so that's all for this episode. You can listen to this on talkingstuff.net/app and of course on any podcast player of your choice. Do send in your comments and feedback on appodcast@talkingstuff.net, and also check out the Talking Tech podcast. There's no space between talking and tech, so it's the Talking Tech podcast. Search for it on any podcast player for tech news, analysis, and amazing app and game picks. So until next time, keep listening and bye-bye.
Bye-bye. A magnificent strike into the crowd.